Right, everybody, welcome to this, the strongest, most stable podcast of all time in the national interest and all that sort of stuff. This is Linux Voice. It's podcast series 5, episode 9. We are all here to talk to you and listen to you sometimes, converse, chat, fireside blether about that Linux and stuff. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Ben Everard.
I'm Graham Morrison.
And I'm Mike Saunders.
And in a special international bonus, bit of bonusery, we've also got a Mexican joining us today. It's Effie.
Hello, I'm Efren Hernandez.
Hello. Hey, Effie.
It's Effie. Hello. Brilliant. Hey. Oh,
you're looking amazing for 21.
Hola. I know.
That little bit of Vaseline you put on the lens is really working.
It's not just there, it's somewhere else.
That's what we need.
So still to come, we have innuendos, we have the news, we have our discoveries / finds, we have the neurons, which may or may not exist, and we also have Voice of the Masses. So if you like that sort of thing, why not subscribe to Linux Magazine, where you can read all of our words. And instead of listening to them, it's basically better and more convenient because you're not limited by battery life or anything like that. And they've been run through a spell checker and stuff, so we're not just spouting our usual nonsense. That can be obtained from all good news agents, of course.
We also promised to mention that this is issue 200 of Linux Magazine.
Yep.
And I think it includes a DVD with every Creative Commons issue of Linux Voice magazine on it,
which is the DVD with issue 200 includes a searchable HTML version of all the content as well as the PDFs, so it's pretty much the entire Linux Voice archive on a disk, and there are lots of articles in there, lots of tutorials and features that still be relevant today, even ones we wrote 2 or 3 years ago, like my Vim tutorial, for instance. Vim never changes, so yeah, that's still cool.
Yeah. All the programming stuff, all the stuff about freedom.
Yep.
That's actually a monumental slab of asset there to have. And it's going to save you an awful lot of Googling about, isn't it? It's our work is and was excellent. We never made it the easiest to find stuff.
No, we were too busy writing it, weren't we?
Yeah, having it all on one DVD would be absolutely well worth the cover price.
We left our marketing department behind. Didn't we, Effie?
Yeah.
Still, that's all in the past now. We've all got over it, right?
I haven't.
No, aww. I haven't.
It's like old mm-hmm. times. We've got Effie here, so let's press on and get on to some stuff about the news.
The news, you say? Right. This fortnight, or whatever it is since the last podcast, there's been a bit happening in the Linux world and a lot happening in the computing world. Let's start with something that's not sad and move on to things that are sad later on. So first up in the news, this fortnight, Toyota goes with Linux for its in-car computers. This isn't just any old Linux, this is automotive grade Linux, which is a kind of collaborative thing between a whole bunch of car manufacturers, to create an open source basis for all their cars, or at least the sort of computery bits of their cars, on the basis that it can all, it will be easier to develop and we'll have better software on our cars. According to Toyota, there's around 100 million lines of software, lines of code in your average car, and about 70% of these could just be standardized across all the all the cars. Is that something like 700 million? No, 70 million. I can't do maths. There are 70 million lines of code per car saved by using open source software.
That's like the way we share 70% of our DNA with a goldfish. Like, a lot of it's just cell metabolism and, you know, how to make fat cells and stuff. makes no sense reproducing that across all different manufacturers, so why not share?
Yeah, that's an odd way of putting it.
That's how we roll.
Yeah. Okay, next up in the happy news section, this Nextcloud 12 has been released, and it's got what they call global scale, which is a whole bunch of technologies for meaning that you can scale up your Nextcloud instances to cope with vast numbers of users. So it's been working reasonably well on small deployments. I mean, we've used it at various times. But it did creak a little bit when you really cranked the numbers up and tried to spread it across more hardware. This has all sorts of load balancy distributed thingies that I only vaguely understand.
But Nextcloud is really awesome. We use it at the Document Foundation for various things, although it's got some slightly annoying limitations. You can't, if you have a public calendar, you can't embed it into another website. If you try and put it in an iframe, it just gets all messed up and tries to redirect too much. But otherwise, it's really good. It's really shiny, really well polished now. I remember using OwnCloud. You know, 2 or 3 years ago when it started to get popular, and Nextcloud is just keeps going up and up. It's really smooth to use. Good work, team.
I haven't had a chance to use it, but I think I remember reading in the press release that they'd totally re-engineered their kind of file sharing and the way that it was supposed, the global scale thing is supposed to be so much more efficient, which even on a small scale, I think will work really well.
Quite possibly, yeah. I mean, I use it myself. Well, I'm still running an old OwnCloud on a Raspberry Pi as a backup server, so everything I save in a directory is saved. But, you know, my data requirements are kind of small. But, yeah, I think I read the same thing as well. Like, OwnCloud, Nextcloud have always been fine for home use, but for actually storing serious amounts of data, they were a bit slow and flaky. So yeah, if they've re-engineered it, then cool.
Yeah, there's a lot. I'm just skipping through their press release now, and there's an awful lot of words. But it would be really good to try it because it. I mean, even when we used it, it felt like it was creaking a little bit, just as Ben said. So, if they've solved that problem, that's a major hurdle.
Yeah. Plus, using Hadoop at work, and it's a pain in the backside to set up. So, if you can just use Nextcloud instead of HDFS, you know. It'll probably work. Right, next up on the news this fortnight. And we've had quite a bit of positive news from Microsoft over the last year or so. So let's get back to some good old-fashioned bad news from Microsoft. And that's that MS is blocking Linux, in inverted commas, in their Windows 10S. So Windows 10S is their sort of Chrome OS killer, as they like to put it. It's a really sort of lightweight, stripped down, what's it thingy for, you know, little computers for education mainly, where it sort of kind of limits what you can do, but, you know, in doing that, it stops you messing it up is the basic idea of it. And part of that is that they've blocked all command line, PowerShell, et cetera, which is where the whole Linux in inverted commas on Windows sort of lay. So this is stuff like the Ubuntu on Windows where you had the command line access to all the bash and all goodness like that. That's been blocked, apparently in the name of education. Now, I'm no expert on education, but I don't think blocking people to have access for educational tools is a good way to go about education.
I mean... I'm as open-minded as anyone about Microsoft. I like the fact that they're getting involved in the discussions. They're part of, you know, they're part of the democratic engagement that is Linux. They're a big contributor to the kernel for optimizing it for its use in Azure. That's what open source is about. But I think it's always debatable whether Microsoft has been doing anything kind of altruistic. I mean, just a couple of months ago, didn't we have the Office 365 bug that, you know, made Linux web browsers so slow in comparison to its competitors, and there's always the threat of patent as well. This is something we brought up with Microsoft joining
Linux Foundation.
Sorry, thanks. Yeah, the Linux Foundation. The fact is that they have this sort of Damocles threat of patents over so many of the other Linux vendors, and it's so difficult to tell. It's just good business, and I don't really blame them for that. But does that mean that we should be any kinder or more accepting of them as a classic open source Linux vendor? No, I don't think so, and I don't think Microsoft does anything to prove otherwise.
And I think this all might just come back to bite them anyway. If this new Windows version doesn't have all these cool command line tools, which people find useful for learning about computers as well. I mean, I haven't used Windows in Windows 10 barely at all, but I don't imagine out of the box it comes with many useful things like programming languages, maybe QBasic, or, you know, so if they're selling this as an educational platform, what you want, Linux distributions are perfect for that. Out of the box, you've got editors, compilers, you know, in terms of IT education at least. So, and, yeah, it just seems a rather daft move.
You know, and I know we've... I don't want this to turn into a rant against Microsoft. I think Microsoft is a company that's looking after its best interests, and there's loads of smart people working there, and they've done some really good stuff. But the thing that worries me is, like, for example, at one of my daughter's school, every computer runs Windows, and all they're using it for is the same kind of educational stuff that you could do with Linux. And I can't help but be deeply cynical about the reasons why they're doing this is to kind of, I don't want to say breed, but that's how it feels, familiarity with a certain system, with calling something a PowerPoint when, you know, it's a piece of specific proprietary software. And it's a long time since I've had to think about this, but Microsoft's kind of backed into a corner, and maybe, you know, these kind of aspects of its policy are going to become more uncomfortable as we go closer to, you know, open source and Linux being used everywhere.
Also, Mike, I've just checked. It doesn't come with QBasic.
Oh, no. So you can't even write Gorilla or Donkey, or what was the one that Bill Gates wrote? I think it was Donkey.
Apparently, QBasic was dropped in Windows 2000 or ME or one of those around then.
So I'm just 17 years behind the time then. In fact, that Linux Voice, Linux Magazine listeners, that should be a good sign. I know so little about Windows. Yeah. I don't even know what's happened in 17 years.
But I've heard that Mike does know quite a lot about Linux, and he's even written a book to prove it.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, let's plug the book.
There have been people on Twitter saying they just received the book, and it's awesome and made their day, you know, Mike.
Really? I didn't see that. Yeah. Oh, cool. They ordered it. The Haynes coding manual, teaching you Python from beginners to pretty advanced, I'd say. A lot of object orientation stuff in there.
Yeah. What's the ISBN number?
There's a 9 in there, so, you know, just sort of work it out from there.
So I'll get on with the news in a minute. I've just got distracted by Twitter looking at Mike Saunders.
There's some metal band player in America called Mike Saunders, and I think a baseball player, and they're way cooler than me and way more successful than me. So
whatever you do, don't go on YouTube and look for the video of Mike Saunders staring at you for whatever it is, half an hour.
I only managed 10 minutes, actually, yeah.
That's just too weird.
There's a guy who apparently calls himself Influential Entrepreneur Mike Saunders, MBA.
Oh, you found me at last.
Yes. Scroll back through my vast array of tabs open, look back. Yes, news. How could I have forgotten? What's happened? Well, the next bit of the news... it's essentially that computers have attempted to rise up and destroy humanity.
good luck, computers.
Good last. Go.
Yeah, our humanity died years ago. So this is the news. Windows took down the health sector. BA just decided to stop working their computers. And Intel's AMT, Active Management Technology, sort of falls over and lets all sorts of bad people into your computers to, I don't know, do bad things, put rude words into your documents just before you hand them in for your assignments and that sort of thing, no doubt.
Always happens.
It just seems that an awful lot of computers are breaking at the moment. Not really any specific advice I have on that other than make better computers, I guess.
Well, there is one specific bit of advice, isn't there? And that seems to be don't use Windows.
Well, yeah, that would have helped against the WannaCry, which took down the hospitals and whatnot. But the AMT stuff, that's sort of baked into Intel chips. And you're just kind of a bit screwed with that. I mean, Intel have decided to make wildly insecure chips. AMD have decided to follow suit. And so... that's your options, really. Have a wildly unsecure computer. Welcome to the future.
Or use a Raspberry Pi 3 as your daily driver, I guess, then.
Yeah. I mean, if you sort of gaffer tape 10 of them together, you might get a fairly powerful computer.
I'll use one of those programmable open RISC things.
Yeah, I mean, there's loads of quite interesting stuff coming along, but let's be honest, for real work, you need an Intel or AMD CPU at the moment. I mean, that may not always be the case. You know, that the ARM chips are getting better, the RISC-V chips are looking quite interesting, but they're not everyday powerful chips at the moment. All the everyday powerful chips have unsecure software running in the heart of them that you can't turn off. Great.
Oh, well.
So, yeah, on that happy note, I shall finish the news for this fortnight.
Oh, that leaves us on to finds of the... It's been 3 weeks, hasn't it? Okay, so the IRC channel. I did ask them earlier on. Quite a few people responded. Let's see if I can quickly go through without causing a huge kerfuffle of delays. John the Nice Guy said he emailed me a find. I need to sign in to email and see what that find is. Tracy C. I have a find I just found useful for anyone running a web server. There's a flag to nmap that will evaluate the ciphers you're using for encrypted secure traffic and lets you know if you have any weak ones. The command is nmap hyphen small s capital V. Oh, it's longer than that. I'll put that in the podcast notes. And that's about it from IRC. I have got a couple of finds, but I don't know if I'm ready to bring them out yet.
Okay.
Oh, dear, Graham.
And does anyone want to have a go first?
Can I kick
go,
us off?
Go, Andrew.
So this is a re-find of a find, but I've re-found it because of the context, because of the fifth man who we have here. So this find is from the University of Oxford Museums Trust, and that is that in 2018, at the Bodleian Libraries, there's going to be a great big exhibition of Tolkien stuff. Over to you, Effie.
Effie, have you been to Oxford yet?
Not yet. But now that I got time in my hands, I will be traveling, definitely. Yeah, no, I'm... actually, it's been quite long since I revisited my my favorite books and my favorite films, but it would be... Now that I rediscover you, guys.
Yeah.
I might go back to my roots. So no, it'd be fantastic.
It's so good to see it.
So can I go to this exhibition? Can I get a special invitation or something?
After we've left Brexit, we might chuck you out.
Effie has pledged allegiance to the Queen, which is something that I haven't done since Cubs.
Oh yeah, that's more than I've done.
Never done that. Who's the Queen?
Okay, so the website I'm looking on doesn't have a date, which is not all that helpful, but there's the words Bilbo and Baggins and Shire are all in there. So it's all good. Original manuscript of the Silmarillion, images of the draft manuscript of The Hobbit, the original artwork that Tolkien did. All the stuff that you can just stare at for hours and hours and hours because it's just so damn cool.
Did Tolkien do the artwork for Lord of the Rings as well?
Yeah, he did illustrations.
Oh, wow. So he went over to...
The original ones.
So he went over to New Zealand to draw the hills and stuff.
Yeah. They when they made New Zealand, they did it. It's like Canaletto when they rebuilt Warsaw.
Oh, right, yeah.
They made New Zealand based on his preliminary draft.
Hold on, I didn't think New Zealand really existed. I thought it was a fictional land. You're telling me now it's real.
Well, this is what, I don't know, the mainstream media wants
to say. Fake news.
This is good, and it's great to see you guys. When was the last time I saw you during Christmas? We went down to Bristol we've
all met each other a couple of times over the last few years, but yeah, it's been 4 years since we left Linux Format. 4 years in.
No, but I saw you in Bristol. I saw you in Bristol in a pub.
Yeah, I saw you in Bristol.
So it was really cool to see you there, the guys, and it's really nice to see you. I met with Graham last Wednesday.
We went to see Alien Covenant, didn't we? And then decided not to go and see Alien Covenant.
Yeah, the day was just too good, and the beer was too delicious. So
yeah, the beer was excellent. In the pub.
Where were you?
But I did go to. Where were we?
It was the
Brew House.
Yeah, the Brew House. The Brew House.
Oh yeah, I'd do like to be there.
Beautiful, warm evening out in the back.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, it was really lovely, but I did go to see Alien 2 days ago. I'm a fan, so yeah, it's really cool. It's really, really good, and it really ties the story to Prometheus, which basically was a film that not many people liked, but I thought it was good.
I liked it.
So well, now that I've seen this film, it's good.
We went to see Prometheus. We bunked off work when we both in our old job to go and watch a movie in one afternoon, and it was just so stupid. But I must say that I've since bought it and watched it a couple of times, and I like it as like an expression of things of like alienness. It's good, and that's why, despite all the reviews for Covenant, I was interested to go and see it. You know, it's I don't know.
Well, I think you should go and see it because it really makes when you combine the two of them, and then you look forward to the old films. They do make. It's like closing the loop, but not exactly closing it. It's just another link on it, on the storyline. But it's the actual film, the production of the film, and the it's just brilliant. It's really good.
Okay, I'll have to find someone else to go and see it now you've seen it.
Oh no, I can go and see it again. Never mind. As long as there's beer available, I go.
Okay. Well, actually, it was. I can't imagine a better evening anyway than having a few pints rather than going and seeing film.
Absolutely, it was lovely.
Does anyone else want to share a find? Okay,
I've got a couple.
Okay, go, Mike.
Yeah. So the first find, you may remember the Humble Indie Bundle. I can never say properly. The collection of games, indie games produced by independent developers that you could buy a collection of games and just pay what you wanted. I think pay anything from $1 upwards and get a bunch of games for your Linux box. Well, Jan Goyveerts has alerted me to the Humble Book Bundle, which, as the name suggests, is a similar scheme, but you can buy books. These are digital books, but it's $429 worth of digital books, and you can get them apparently paying $1 or more. Although it looks like from the website, it's $1 or more for 3 books, and then it goes up for 8 books and so forth. But they're all DRM free. They're all multi-format. You support charities doing this way. Looking at the site, they seem to all be A-Press books. But from what I've seen, I've looked at a few A-Press books that seem pretty good. So, I mean, a lot of them are quite technical topics, Git, Docker, Ansible, OpenStack. But there's some sort of more user-facing ones like Ubuntu and Vim, if you can call Vim user-facing. But yeah, the Humble Book Bundle, whoever came up with that name is, and then my second find was the other day I went...
Hang on, is the Haynes programming guide on part of this Humble Book Bundle?
No, because people should pay at least £13.84, whatever Amazon's selling it for. Do you not
like charities, Mike? Do you not want to look after your fellow
man? I think charity begins at home, but in other people's homes. So, it's nothing to do with me. So the second find that I found was when I was looking at the Scribus website recently, or Scribus, as Germans call
it. Oh, is it?
By the way.
Oh,
yeah.
I have to add that to my...
This is why you have LibreOffice and LibreOffice and...
Right.
Yeah.
Hang on, LibreOffice?
I've heard a lot of things. LibreOffice, Libre, LibreOffice, Libre. Yeah. So Scribus... Yeah?
Mike's seen sea beams glittering in the dark.
I've seen things you guys just, I really don't want to you take Europeans. This podcast down. Over here on the continent is so bad. So Scriber/Scriber/whatever. Anyway, yeah. So on the Scribus website, I just thought the introduction paragraph was interesting. It says, "Welcome to Scribus, a page layout program for Linux, FreeBSD, PCBSD, NetBSD, OpenBSD, Solaris, OpenIndiana, Debian GNU/Herd, macOS, OS2 Warp 4, EcomStation, Haiku, and Windows." Respect.
Oh, that
respect.
Is brilliant. That is brilliant.
Because I bet Windows is by far the most downloaded platform, even though we all associate it with open source, just like LibreOffice. The vast brilliant. Majority of downloads are for Windows. So I love the way they just tacked it on the end there, even with some completely bizarre things like Debian GNU/Herd and EcomStation that, you know, sort of trundling along. But anyway, those are my two finds.
Thank you, Mike. I've found John the Nice Guy's email. He has two interesting finds for the next podcast. https://www.smartyhome.com. Not open source nor free software, however, a useful app for reminding yourself when you've not mowed the lawn or cleaned blades on your fans, he says. And then the other one is flow-.co, open source MIT license. It's a to-do list. Habits reminder, personal journal that integrates with Pocket, Evernote, Google Fit, GitHub, and Goodreads. So they're John's finds. Thank you, John. My Amiga,
been waiting for this.
The Amiga graphics card I talked about ages ago, the VA2000, and that arrived, and I stuck it in my Amiga 4000. It's brilliant. It's really cool. It's expensive. The cool thing is that it's got this little expansion that plugs into the video slot on those big, so you can see all those old screen resolutions pumped through the HDMI output and get a modern video output for those old games without promoting the screens. So it works with loads of things.
Now, hang on, so its main features, it allows your modern screen to look worse.
Yeah, it does. It basically, I'm not going to waste too much time on it, I promise. But yeah, there is no way of getting those old screen modes out of the Amiga. There were things called scan doublers and all kinds of various hacks. You needed to get a monitor very specific 15 or 30 frequencies, vertical frequencies, to be able to show them. You couldn't do it, and you can't do it even on modern Amigas. So what this, I think what this just does is use the FPGA to basically scan the output from the video bus to sample it basically and push it back into the same video stream as the rest of it. That appears to be what it does. It kind of works. It's a bit glitchy, but it does work. I've been playing some games on that, and it's nice to have a modern graphics card on my Amiga. Now, my other find, moving on from this, it's nothing to do with that. I went camping in Devon at the weekend. And the reason why I went camping in Devon was to go to a really wonderful charity hospice and a charity shop run by St. Luke's Hospice in Plymouth to pick up a keyboard that I'd been looking for, a synthesizer keyboard. It cost me £35. It's here. I can't show you, but it's quite heavy. It's actually much bigger than I thought when I looked at it online. And the interesting thing about this keyboard is it's the same kind used by Leonard Cohen to record the future and see. Leonard Cohen is a genius poet. So let's see if I can create some of these beats. I can't see. I'm sat completely in the dark. Where is it? Come on, Leonard. So the spirit of Leonard Cohen is failing me a little bit here. That's it. I'll probably cut all that out when I actually edit the podcast.
No, don't.
No, don't do that.
That's great. We've got some music to start the podcast with now as well.
Yeah. Are there any finds left? Ben?
I kind of... It's about computers and it's kind of dull now. Some of it, you know, the oldest bit's only like 2 years old. I'll start with my most exciting find in the hope that can compete with Graham's, but it fails. And that's it. The Stack Overflow question, how to exit Vim, has now passed 1 million views.
That's brilliant. And are people trolling on there? Are they doing like Emacs commands just to confuse people? Or that's what I would do.
I would have no idea how to exit Emacs. I assume I have to press Control Meta something. But
yeah, I can't think off the top of my head either. No. Control S C or I don't know. That's probably the second most viewed question on Stack Overflow.
Not that many people use Emacs.
True.
My second find is that there was an issue last year with kids in Ethiopia using the internet to cheat on their exams. And in response to this year, during the exams, the school exams, national GCSE equivalents, Ethiopia has just turned off the internet for the entire country.
I saw this. I think that's an absolutely awesome response. That'll learn them.
Yeah. Cheat on your exams, fine. We'll just cut off the internet to the entire country. Cheat now.
Wow.
Yeah. So students have been forced to copy off the person next to them now.
What about Netflix? How are they getting their American gods?
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of unfair, because what happens if you happen to be sat next to an idiot? At least with the internet, it was kind of democratic. You could copy off someone. Everyone could copy off someone smart.
What happens if you're if you're not a student and you're just trying to, land some aeroplanes or, Google for someone's symptoms in a GP's office or something?
If you're trying to land an aeroplane, it's probably best to turn off Netflix and just land the aeroplane.
But they use the internet nowadays
to land aeroplanes.
London City Airport.
Yeah,
they're closing their control tower, and they're moving the base, the control tower, to a virtual control tower in Surrey or Hampshire somewhere, and they've got a closed little private internet. So not the actual internet, but still it's an internet of sorts. So instead of looking out of windows, they look at screens that simulate the windows, and this is somehow better because of technology.
Okay.
Yeah. That was just an example. I mean, just an example of being a non-cheating student.
Yeah.
Using the internet in Ethiopia.
Fair enough. I assume they have control towers next to their airports. I don't know.
God, that's so primitive and Luddite of them.
And my final find is, I don't even know how to pronounce this, SSH Uttle? Uttle,
yeah,
maybe?
That is awesome.
I don't know how to describe it. It allows you to redirect all of your internet traffic via an SSH connection into another computer. So I use it if I need to connect into another network. It's kind of like creating a VPN connection. You use SSH Uttle, and everything from your computer appears to come from the computer that you've SSH'd into. So if you need to, access a website that's only on a LAN that you're not on, you can SSH into a machine on the LAN using SSH Uttle or Shuttle or however you pronounce it, and then access it as though you're on that machine. And it's awesome in all sorts of ways when you're using a lot of remote machines with weird security configurations.
It's really cool for those kind of virtual machine-only networks when you want to kind of pipe your way from a host through to something running within a machine. It's really good for that.
We've got a lot of machines where we only sort of services only listen on the internal interface, not on the public facing interface, and just for security reasons, and it sort of allows you to access those from wherever.
Yeah. And as you say, I use it as a VPN as well to access stuff via my server in the US.
Those are my finds.
I've completely lost track. Effie, have you got any finds?
Well, I wasn't prepared really for the podcast. So
we found you. That's more important. Really.
none of us are prepared.
No, I wasn't prepared.
I don't know. What have I found? Not much really. I found out that I'm an individual. That is one thing. No, but I'm punching and kicking people. So through the martial arts, I mean, through competition in martial arts. I've been
so since we last spoke. Sorry, yeah. You've taken out your anger and frustration on other people within a sparring environment by taking up.
There hasn't been any anger or frustration. It's just been meditation and movement, really. Yeah. That's where it's been. But no, I've been.
Is this it's Taekwondo or Judo?
Oh, it's called Tangsudo. It's a traditional Korean martial art. It's pre Taekwondo, but. It is quite an amazing thing, thinking that...
Taekwondo for hipsters.
Yeah, we wear scarves instead of belts. No, it's quite an amazing thing, entering this crazy universe of martial arts, because you kind of discover yourself. It's such a strange thing, just as music or as any... artistic expression, really. It's quite bizarre. It's been the last 4 years, they've been just awesome, absolutely awesome, and pretty much it's down to that, down to the practice of Tangsudo.
So I thought you were going to say it was because we left.
No, that had nothing to do with it.
4 years would be awesome. 4 years would be awesome without.
No, but they've been also. It's been awesome just to sort of see what physically, and it sounds silly, but spiritually as well. I don't know. It's a fantastic vehicle to sort of think in a more internal way. But yeah, if anyone ever sort of thought about practicing martial arts and they thought that because of the, I don't know, the physical abilities, they thought that they wouldn't be able to do it. Just rethink it and just give it a try. You just never know. You might find that you are capable. Yeah, that's my discovery. But that's an old one because it's been 4 years since I started.
Yeah, that's really cool though, Effie. So you're thinking of becoming a black belt?
Yeah, but yeah. Everything depends on time, money, and
on the end of level boss.
What?
The end of level boss.
Yeah.
Isn't it going to be somebody with like a minigun for an arm?
Yeah, it's
and then a serpent coming out of its neck and two heads.
It's just like that.
That's what we have to do. BBA, BBA, ABBA.
Such a gig, honestly.
Martial arts. Martial arts. Let's move on. That's everybody's finds. Have I forgotten somebody? I don't know. Sorry.
No, we've all found something.
Right.
That's great. That brings us triumphantly to the halfway point. Still to come. We've may or may not have some neurons to vocalise. We definitely do have the voice of the masses. Now, as I'm holding the conch, I'm going to remind you all that at www.linux-magazine.com you can subscribe to Linux Magazine, now incorporating Linux Voice, which we write. So if you want to read our words rather than just listening to us, that's the place to do it. Also, go to the shops and buy issue 200, because you will find a massive DVD archive of all the old back issues.
We have a neuron sent in to us from Darren Drapkin, and he writes the following. I am a big fan of APL, the anti-programming language. I spend ages writing long, complex code in it. In APL, that means functions more than 10 lines long. Then I find that the whole exercise I've been working on can be done with only 2 or 3 characters by themselves that I have never used before. You can express vast, complicated mathematical expressions in only a few keystrokes. Its original purpose was to communicate between mathematicians, computer scientists, and so on. When it started off as an executable, real machine-readable programming language, its main use was manipulating huge data sets with short code snippets. Nowadays, this is termed big data. What I use APL for nowadays is to help me think about how programming languages should be and do the sort of things in a few lines of code that takes over 2 gigabytes in a modern spreadsheet. So thanks for that, Darren. But of course, it does pose the question, I think, for a lot of us, what is this APL anti-programming language you mentioned? So being the top quality real news journalist that I am, I look up on Wikipedia and it says, APL is a programming language developed in the 1960s by Kenneth Iverson. Its central data type is the multidimensional array. It uses a large range of special graphic symbols to represent most functions and operators, leading to very concise code. It has been an important influence on the development of concept modeling spreadsheets, functional programming, and computer math packages, and it's still used today in certain applications. So I'll send the I'll make sure Graham has the link so we can put it in the podcast notes.
You won't.
Okay, I'm pretty good with that, I think. I've done it at least a quarter of the time. But like, you can write the whole game of life in, I'm looking at an example here, and it's just random squiggly marks, and it looks like various phonetic from characters from the phonetic alphabet, but there's probably about 20, 30 characters you can write the whole game of life. It's very, very bizarre. It's a fantastic, it should be a find, really, but it's a great neuron. But yeah, I'm on a mission now, Graham. I'll send you the link. That's the most important thing in my life right now for the next 15 minutes. So those are the neurons. Thank you very much for that, Darren. If anybody else wants to send me something really cool like that, would help. Then email me, mike@linuxvoice.com.
Right, that brings us on to Voice of the Masses. We asked you, the masses, us, the masses, what's your favourite web browser? You may have seen the Chrome One article that's been doing the rounds recently. It's written by a former Mozilla CTO and well worth a read. And it gave us an idea for our next Voice of the Masses. What's your favourite web browser and why? So, could someone pricey the Chrome One article for me by a former Mozilla CTO? I haven't actually looked at it.
I think it might be about a web browser that's developed by Google called Chrome that started as an underdog. And let me, I don't know how, what Google's direct motivation was, but let's say that it was, if they could own the application that people use to access the internet, maybe they may also own the data that people use to access the internet via their browser. So they went ahead and they started off with Apple's WebKit, which was a fork of QHTML, and they forked it and they created their own web engine and they made very fast JavaScript interpreter. And over time, they've come to dominate the web and everybody seems to install them by default. Not least because whenever you Google anything through Google, it says, have you installed Chrome? We notice Chrome isn't your default browser. You must go and install Chrome, and it's become the basis and foundation for lots of other things. And I haven't read the article myself, but I'm assuming that Chrome now has market dominance when it comes to web browsers.
There's a fantastic graph here on this article, which shows even as late as 2012, it still shows Internet Explorer as being the most used web browser, which is absolutely crazy. Like, and even the height of Firefox, which Firefox has been the default de facto king of the internet for as long as I can remember. The towards the far left of the graph, that the highest position it's achieved was 30% market share. And it, you know, back in 2011, it shows there's quite a fragmented market, but Chrome really has achieved dominance now.
Yeah.
Quite, some would say, unhealthily so.
Well, I mean, it is open source in essence. There are big parts of it that aren't open source. I guess that hasn't smartphone tablet browsing overtaken desktop browsing, and you know, Chrome by default in those situations is dangerous because it's a whole new step to try and install Firefox, and you know, on iOS then that you're further restricted. Yeah, I suppose, you know, we've exchanged one situation for another. Google's done a lot for, like, as usual, I don't know why I'm talking about this, but as usual, there's a kind of a dichotomy with Google. There's a good side and there's a bad side. And the bad side, of course, is that Google owns this, but Google owns it because it did the right thing and to start off with, it's open source. There are lots of projects using the same web engine. These are some of the projects that people have chosen as their favorite browsers that wouldn't necessarily be so comprehensive if they weren't using Google's web engine.
It seems to me that even at school level, at primary and secondary school level, even kids prefer to use Google Chrome. And it seems to me that because of its popularity, every single computer now seems to be like a Chromebook or a Google device. It just seems quite strange. I was talking to Rosie, my daughter, the other day, and I was installing Linux on her computer, and the first thing she wanted was browser installed on it, and it just came automatically. It's almost like it seems to be like it's like a philosophy, like hovering across people in the schools. It's just such a strange thing. I don't know whether that was intended or whether it just basically appears as by magic, or I don't know. But yeah, to me, now everyone seems to be using that browser. It almost seems that they converted the machine into a Google Chrome, something similar, similar device.
You don't need to have, if there are five browsers out there, they don't need an even 20% market share each for there to be a certain viable number of alternatives. No. Let's get on to the comments. So Tuscan says, cute browser, because I'm a big VI fan and this browser can be controlled just like it. But out of necessity, I also use Chrome Chromium because there's no LastPass support yet for cute browser. Mike says, Firefox has always worked well for me, and since I don't use Chromium, I don't know what I'm missing. I know Mozilla gets all sorts of criticism, but I do think they will keep making Firefox better, and that's what matters to me. And I think this is the killer sentence here. As for the supposed victory of Chrome, the entire world can browse in whatever they want, as long as I get to use what I want. As a Linux user, I don't need my technology sources validated by the majority.
Yeah, but there was a time when it didn't work. You know, when Internet Explorer was so dominant, you couldn't, as a Linux user, you couldn't access your bank and you couldn't do really essential things. I mean, that's the problem. That was the problem. And that's the way that it feels like it's kind of bordering on in some aspects. Netflix, for example, on Linux.
What really annoys me is you can't use Hangouts on Firefox. It's Google. You can make web chat work on Firefox.
And they stopped it.
Yeah, and they just broke it. And they just say, oh, sorry, it's broken. Yeah. Well, fix it then. Yeah. You're one of the world's biggest companies.
You know, in their algorithm of world domination, that they've passed a threshold of influence where they no longer have to care about Firefox.
I'd love to see this algorithm of world domination. If there's a graph and how far along the graph we are.
Yeah, I bet there is. It's all run by, you know, they've retired the Go AI. The Go AI is now running Google.
We have lots more comments, rather. So John says, Chrome at home, Firefox at work. Moved to Chrome when Firefox was getting fat and lazy a while back and see no reason to move back. It's a shame about Firefox. I remember when it was a lightweight choice over Mozilla, but those days are long gone. XUp says, I use Opera, which I know is Chrome-based. I just find it incredibly stable and fast. DuckDuckGo is the search engine, and LastPass and Xmarks are the only plugins I use. Malpertus says, Firefox, I don't feel comfortable using Chrome. Javier, I mainly use Safari on my Mac. Lucifer, I always thought of Firefox as a Windows app. Ah, that's interesting. It looks like a Windows app. On KDE looks like crap, on macOS looks like crap. It feels like a Windows app. It's slow as hell since version 2.0. I think you can guess I don't use Firefox. So any non-Firefox browser will do for me. First it was Opera, then Conqueror, now it's Chromium on Linux and OpenBSD and Safari on macOS. Doesn't everything look rubbish on KDE?
Hey.
And it looks wobbly, Andrew. It's wobbly.
Wobbly. It looks like it's shifting paradigms. Phil says Firefox. Keith Peters says Chrome. Okay. Chrome. I'm a web developer. Chrome's dev tools are amazing. Also, since most end users use Chrome, it's the one that most devs use first, with testing on others later. Also, I use a touchscreen laptop, and Firefox hasn't quite figured out how to deal with that yet. Apparently, there are ways to make it work, but after 10 minutes messing with command line arguments and about config settings, I gave up. Dev tools. Ben, you know about this sort of thing. Firefox used to be the best, didn't it? It used to be the tool of choice for web developers.
Well, I always use Firefox. So when I do web dev, I use Firefox. I've no idea if Chrome is better. I've never used it. Firefox tells you if stuff's broken. Sometimes tells you how to fix it. What more do you need as a dev?
I do still see Mozilla as the guardians of the internet, regardless of whether or not Firefox is the number one browser. Does anybody else think that?
I couldn't tell you why I use Firefox. I just like it. So it just gives me a warm, fuzzy feeling inside that Chrome doesn't. Regardless of what websites I'm looking at.
No, I agree with Andrew there that Firefox has had its up and downs over the years. It's quite funny reading the discussions on the Linux Voice comments and in other places as well. Some people are saying, oh, Firefox used to be so slim and light and is now really bloated and heavy. And people are saying the exact same arguments about Chrome. So I think a lot of it depends on usage patterns, you know, how big your history is, how big your cache is. But yeah, I use mostly Firefox. I do a couple of other things in Chromium to keep them separate, like social media, just so it's not even in the same browser, so there isn't that overlap. But yeah, Firefox, for all its ups and downs, all its problems, you still have that feeling, maybe the warm, fuzzy feeling, like Ben says, that the Mozilla Foundation, for all their ups and downs as well, is they do care about a free and open, accessible internet without massive corporate control. I think Google isn't a bad company at the moment, but it is always slightly scary just how much power they have.
Adam Brown says, I stick with Firefox because I'm a rocking chair on the porch Luddite who's so familiar with it and its handy plugins that I can't be bothered learning the Chrome analogs. Firefox does eat more RAM than a shepherd during spring, but I figure what else would I do with that RAM? Watch more U2 videos on YouTube? I'm more of Springsteen myself.
What a guy.
Springsteen is, of course, just nothing more than the thin man's meatloaf.
This is the best podcast.
But the thing is, Meatloaf's massive.
Come on.
But Meatloaf's massive. Think of all the RAM he's going to take off. Springsteen's only little. If you're running Firefox, you can't fit Meatloaf in your RAM as well.
Give me Meatloaf any day. It's all the same. It's just narrative storytelling.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that, but I just think Meatloaf does it bigger and better.
Brings me to the end of
Christian that. Says, I use Firefox because I don't trust Google and Chrome. Moylan, here we go. Vivaldi. Since Opera jumped the shark after version 12 or so, Firefox is circling the drain. I don't trust Chrome or Chromium. They're still adding features, but it's fairly decent. I guess they're still adding features to Vivaldi. No one else has said Vivaldi. Graham W. Firefox, I've used it for years and it just works for me. I use it on my PCs and on my Android devices as well. Kevin O'Brien, I use Chrome and Firefox about evenly. I think Firefox does a better job with security, but I use so many Google apps that Chromium makes sense for managing my Gmail drive, etc. And Bob Moss says Opera, because you get all the benefits of Chrome without the privacy problems. You also get a free, easy-to-use VPN too. Hmm. Opera. I'd forgotten all about Opera. It's still there. It still exists.
Yeah, she's still plugging away. Oh, Opera, yeah.
She's not just plugging away, is she? She's doing quite well for herself. The answer is Firefox, with a few people using Vivaldi and a few people using Opera. No one's mentioned Brave.
I use Brave on my phone, not on my desktop.
Tell us a wise one. What's it all about?
Well, to be honest, I don't know. I installed it because it seemed interesting, like when it first came out, and I thought I'd give it a go, and I never got around to switching back. It works quite well. The main quite cool thing about it is that you can load pages in the background, and it tells you when they're loaded. So if you're like looking at your Twitter app, and you think, oh, I want to open that link, you click on the link, it doesn't open the web browser. It loads it in the background and then says, ah, this page is loaded. So you're not staring at a screen waiting for adverts to load 2 minutes before the actual content of the page loads.
But that feature was in browsers many, many years ago, back in the days when I had dial-up, and lots of people were concerned that it would be downloading pages in the background that you wouldn't necessarily want to visit or could, you know, let's say cause problems. But you are then, according to your ISP, you're visiting all these pages. So you look at a Twitter feed, and if some of them are linking to dodgy material and...
No, it's not. I don't mean like that. It doesn't just open up all the URLs. I have to click on the URL to start it loading. It's not
okay. So sorry, I don't get what you mean by.
So I'm looking at my Twitter feed, and there's a URL, and I think, oh, I want to visit that page. I click on the page, and it doesn't open the web browser. It opens a little circle to the side that sort of shows that page loading.
Ah.
So I don't have to stare at the web browser while the page loads. It loads, and I can keep reading Twitter. Because I'm that cool, and you know, I might miss some important cat videos or something.
Right, I got you. No, that makes sense. That makes sense. So you don't have to sit waiting for watching blank tabs slowly get populated with data. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I can scroll through Twitter, find all the links to cat videos that I want to watch, click on all of them, and they all load, and then I can go back and look at kittens falling over.
What about videos of Begbie? We should get some videos of Begbie. We can hear him there.
I think he's just been shown the videos of cats.
All right then. Okay, so in slightly edited format, that's it. That's the end of the podcast. We're all going to go off now and do something else. So we'll see you in 2 weeks. Goodbye, everybody.
Awesome.
This is what makes it all worthwhile. Such a nice day.